Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaffe in Washington. Ahead, efforts to woo Gulf Cooperation Council members over to the Iran nuclear deal. New U.S. regulations to help curb climate change being unveiled. We'll hear about the keys to happiness.
The first key is to understand the true relationship between the conscious and subconscious areas of our mind.
And once again, controversy swirls around the estate of the late singer Whitney Houston. It's all ahead on The Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Doha, Qatar, Monday, meeting with the foreign ministers of the Gulf Cooperation Council to convince them last month's international nuclear agreement with Iran will bring more security to the Middle East. My colleague Victor Beatty is following all this and joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Well, hello, Susan. Mr. Kerry, whose first stop was Cairo Sunday, spoke after meeting with Egypt's foreign minister, Sameh Shoukry.
Let me be very clear. The United States has labeled Iran the number one state sponsor of terror in the world. And the United States has taken steps over the course of the last years to try to deal with the reality of the destabilizing choices that have been made. But I have one simple fact to put in front of everybody. If Iran is destabilizing, it is far, far better to have an Iran that doesn't have a nuclear weapon than one that does.
Mr. Kerry said he is absolutely convinced the region is safer by keeping Iran to a one-year breakout to a nuclear weapon for a period of 10 years, safer with international inspections, safer with reductions in Iran's uranium-enriched stockpile, and safer with an adopted process under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that Tehran has to live by for the lifetime of the agreement. Regional analyst Stephen Zunis told me via Skype the real concern among Gulf nations is the potential for closer cooperation between Washington and Tehran at their expense.
The problem with the Gulf leaders is less the details of the deal itself, which is, according to most observers, pretty reasonable. And indeed, it reduces the threat to those countries in terms of any potential nuclear confrontation. The problem that the Gulf leaders have is they are afraid that this will open up to a rapprochement between the West and Iran. As a result, Secretary of State Kerry's job is basically to reassure them, if you will, that there are still some serious problems between the United States and Iran, that just as the United States and Soviet Union could sign SALT agreement back when there was confrontation in Vietnam and Central America and Africa, that is perfectly reasonable for the United States to seek arms control while still maintaining this rivalry for geopolitical influence.
Stephen, as you know, the President Obama hosted a meeting of Gulf Cooperation heads of state at Camp David, the presidential retreat near Washington, some weeks ago. Some of them didn't show up, including the prominent one, Saudi King Salman. Was that a sign of their displeasure about the Iran deal?
There are various interpretations as to what might have motivated that. There were quite a few other things to talk about, not just the Iran and nuclear deal, but issues around Yemen, around Israel, around ISIS, around other concerns. But there's definitely somewhat frosty relations. There's great concern about sort of money coming from the Gulf Arab states that are not from the government necessarily, but from elements that are supporting radical Islamists in Syria and elsewhere. And there are also some concerns regarding the unwillingness of the Obama administration to challenge Israel more directly in terms of their creeping annexation of the West Bank, making a two-state solution more and more elusive. There are a whole number of concerns that our Arab Gulf leaders have that go beyond simply the Iran nuclear talks.
Mr. Kerry arrived in Doha from Cairo, where, despite concerns about human rights, the U.S. Sunday resumed formal security talks with Egypt.
Egypt is still considered a very important country by the United States. It's by far the largest country in the Arab world, the center in terms of media, higher education, and other influences. At the same time, the increasing repression, which in many ways has surpassed even the darkest days of the Mubarak era, has led to concerns by many Egyptians and many human rights activists around the world, that this increasing security cooperation between the United States and Egypt is essentially given the military-backed government there a freer hand. But, of course, that doesn't bother the Gulf monarchies because they have their own poor human rights record, and they don't are concerned about comparably bad records in neighboring countries.
Zunda says Mr. Kerry's inaugural strategic dialogue with his Egyptian counterpart underscores the evolving U.S. relationship with Cairo that was interrupted by the military's ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi in 2013 and a subsequent crackdown on Morsi's supporters. As Egypt battles militants, U.S. arms sales were unfrozen last March. But Zunis also says the improved ties risk alienating elements of the Arab world that applauded Mr. Obama in the wake of his 2009 speech at Cairo University, in which he emphasized the themes of democracy and human rights.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Oh.
So Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, is trending on social media today because he is getting an international humanitarian award,
oh.
And a lot of people are taking issue with this. It's coming from Indonesia's Sukarno Center. They're giving him this award that's previously been awarded to Gandhi, to Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. And people are very upset about this, the fact that he's getting this award, saying he's no humanitarian, people taking to social media and talking about how he's been such a terrible leader in North Korea, terrible to his people there. The Sukarno Center is kind of refuting this by saying that they've given the award previously to Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-un's grandfather, saying that he got the award for fighting imperialism. So this, they're calling it a sequel that he's getting the award. So they're saying, don't be surprised that we're giving out this award. We've given it out to a broad mix of people before. And in social media business news, we have a lot of social media companies coming out with earnings, Twitter among them. During their earnings call, they announced they have just over 300 million what they call MAUs, or monthly active users. But they have 1 billion inactive accounts. They've also reported, Business Insider's reporting this. Business Insider's also reporting that Facebook is about 1 billion active users per day. So they said 1/7 of the world checking Facebook per day. They said they've added 173 million new users since last year, bigger than the populations of Germany and the UK combined.
Amazing.
So huge growth for Facebook, and Twitter has a lot of inactive users. They're trying to get that number back up.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
New research from Australia's University of Adelaide is providing evidence that plants, which don't have a nervous system like animals, transmit animal-like signals when they're under stress. The findings show that plants respond to stress in their environment with a combination of chemical and electrical signals that are similar to those emitted by animals under stress. Senior author Matthew Gillingham, a professor at the Australian University, says that it's been long known that an animal neurotransmitter, GABA, is also produced by plants when they encounter stress such as drought, salinity, viruses, acidic soils, or extreme temperatures. The researchers made their findings when they noticed that a plant's neural receptors connected with its corresponding GABA neurotransmitters in a way that's similar in animals. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. President Barack Obama is set to unveil new regulations today aimed at cutting carbon pollution that comes from the nation's power plants. The goal is for plants to reduce their carbon emissions by 32% below 2005 levels by the year 2030. My colleague Michael Lippin asked correspondent Michael Bowman about Mr. Obama's intentions.
Michael, the Obama administration is coming out with new rules, new regulations, by which U.S. power plants, specifically coal-powered plants, would reduce their emissions by just over 30% from the levels that were recorded in 2005. And they would have until 2030 to do so. And this is something that the administration has been discussing for quite some time. But President Obama is coming out with this formally later Monday.
any specific reason for the timing of this announcement coming out on Monday?
I don't know that there's a specific reason for it. What I can tell you is that there are many groups in the Obama coalition, you might say, who have had their backs scratched from those who wanted health care reform to those who wanted gay rights to move to the front of the line, many different elements. But the environmentalists have always felt like sort of the forgotten stepchild. And now in the last 18 months of the Obama administration, it looks like they're going to be getting their due.
They wanted to have their time to be in the spotlight. So what has to happen for these targets for reduced emissions to actually be implemented?
Well, first of all, it would be the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, that would be at the forefront of this. However, the EPA is not going around to each and every power plant and directing them as to what they have to do. Rather, they are going state by state and telling states, this is what you must achieve by the year 2030. We're not going to tell you how to get there. We're not going to tell you line by line what you must do, but this is how you must comply by the year 2030. And they are leaving it up to individual states to go about crafting a plan under the assumption that individual states will do so in the way that is least economically harmful and most beneficial.
How much power do states have to push back on these regulations? Do they have no say whatsoever? Or do they actually have some scope to protest if they want to?
Well, it wouldn't just be the states. It would be their representatives in Congress. Now, this is not something where the administration has to ask Congress for permission. The Obama administration has control over the EPA, and the EPA has a great deal of say as to what happens with power plants. However, if the Republican-led Congress were able to do so, it could pass a law overruling it, or a more likely route for them and for individual states that object to this is to challenge it in court, to challenge it in federal court, to say that this is an overreach of the federal government into individual states. They will make it a question of states' rights versus the rights of the federal government.
And that means potentially the Supreme Court getting involved at some point.
Potentially, if it were to go that high, yes.
VOA's Michael Bowman. Coming up on International Edition, pointers on switching that frown upside down, and the burial of her daughter setting a fire over the Whitney Houston estate. Feel like a gloomy Gus? The glass is always half empty. You can't seem to reach the sunny side of the street? Well, author Jim Jensen has some tips for you to change your life around, and he joins us now on the line. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Susan. Just a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. First of all, what is your first suggestion in your book, Seven Keys to Unlock Your Full Potential?
My first suggestion?
Yes.
Read it.
Okay.
The seven keys, let me talk about the first key. The first key is to understand the true relationship between the conscious and subconscious areas of our mind. These are not two different minds, but rather they're two spheres of the same mind. And most of us have been educated to understand that the subconscious handles our bodily functions. It grows our hair, our nails, will help heal a wound, digests our food. But many people are not aware that the subconscious is also a servo mechanism that works on our behalf 24/7, and it carries out what we command it and what the information we give to it by the conscious area of the mind, and will work just as hard to achieve something that might be negative as something positive. For example, we use a metaphor in the book to visualize an ocean liner going across the sea. And the conscious area of the mind would be like the captain who's up in the helm of the ship, barking out signals to the crew, full speed ahead, port starboard, 10 degrees north, whatever. And the crew is like the subconscious, which could be down in the engine room of the ship, below the water level, can't even see where the ship is going. And they just carry out the orders and say, aye, aye, sir, not minding whether they run the ship into the rocks, hit another vessel, or get it safely to its destination. So this is working, again, on our behalf 24/7. And therefore, it's not so important what we say to others, or what others say to us, but it's extremely important what we say to ourselves.
That's a little trick I have when I have a really difficult day, several shows or something like that, and I wake up and I think, oh no, I've got so much work to do. And then I just say to myself, hey, it's a challenge. You can do it. It'll be fun. And that changes your whole thing. It really is true. It's all in your head.
Exactly. The second key is the incredible power of our own self-talk. And again, although people, when I mention this, will be aware of this, they don't consciously think about it, that we, all of us, talk to ourselves all day long at the rate of 150 to 300 words a minute, over 50,000 thoughts a day, which is called self-talk. I mean, your listeners right now are talking to themselves about what they're hearing. They're assessing what they think about this. They're thinking about the rest of the day. What are they doing for lunch? Where are they going to dinner? I mean, all these thoughts that run through our brain. So again, as I just said a few minutes ago, that we need to be very mindful of what we say to ourselves. And when we catch ourselves, just like you say, gosh, it's a tough day, or I've got too much. So wait a minute, time out, cancel. You know, it's a great day. I've got plenty of energy. I've got plenty of time. And again, re-instruct the subconscious is like the hardware in a computer. And the conscious mind is like the software. It's just data input. We come into the world as a totally empty vessel. We don't have an opinion, thought, belief, attitude about anything. But through well-intending parents, older siblings, coaches, teachers, whatever, we get a lot of data input that begins to shape who we become. But the good news is we have the capacity to reprogram or change any of that data we want through the use of our self-talk. So those are the two kind of combinations of the relationship between the conscious and subconscious, and then being fully, fully aware of how we talk to ourselves. And then we have additional keys in the book that give instructions on how to properly do that and how to properly reprogram the subconscious.
Thank you, Jim. You're tuned to VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Bobby Christina Brown, the deceased daughter of the late Whitney Houston, will rest next to her mother's grave in New Jersey. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Music's Ray McDonald about the mysterious circumstances surrounding the 22-year-old Brown's death and what will become of her mother's estate.
The world was shocked by the death of Bobby Christina Brown recently. She was found face down in a bathtub, very similar to her mother, Whitney Houston. Ray, this is eerie. This is really, really creepy. And January 31st is when they found Bobby Christina unresponsive.
Right.
And so now she's dead, and now it's like all the lawyers are trying to decide what to do with the estate, because she was the sole heir to her mother's fortune.
That's exactly right. And beyond that, prosecutors want to try and figure out who, if anyone, was responsible for the death of Bobby Christina Brown, even though an initial autopsy showed no underlying cause for her death and no injuries.
Now, there was some question about a guy who was her half-brother or an adopted brother and then became her husband.
Nick Gordon.
Nick Gordon. Yeah, what's going on there?
Well, Nick's role in all of this is very nebulous, and I really can't say specifically that he did anything. I mean, he and Bobby Christina were together in her Atlanta area home. He found her face down in the bathtub on January 31st. As I say, the initial autopsy didn't reveal anything, although prosecutors are treating it as a homicide investigation. There will be more tests to come. Bobby Christina herself her funeral will be a private affair, and then she will be flown to New Jersey to be buried alongside her mother, Whitney Houston. This has yet to play out, and I'm not exactly sure how it's going to play out.
And there's a lot of money at stake here. I mean, Whitney Houston, Bobby Christina was the sole heir of Whitney Houston's entire estate. Mm-hmm. Millions upon millions of dollars. Now, her grandmother, Sissy Houston, is still alive, as is her aunt. But according to Whitney Houston's will, everything went to Bobby Christina in a trust, I believe, right?
Everything went to Bobby Christina in a trust. And this is going to be a very tangled case. Legal experts are at odds over exactly how it will come out. But it's going to take a long time and a lot of money.
Now, where's her father, Bobby Brown, in all this? What role is he playing?
Well, right now, Bobby is just saying, you know, he's devastated by the death of his daughter. He tried to be at her side every moment that he could during her 6 months in hospital. I think Bobby is just so emotionally devastated right now that he really has yet to get his bearings.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. If you have any questions or comments about this, you can hit us up at VOA_music. That's our Twitter handle. You can also send a tweet to VOA_IE. Listen for Ray to count down the top 20 and the top 5 hits of the week. You can find that at www.voanews.com.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department reviews efforts by foreign governments to combat human trafficking. The use of children as soldiers by nations and armed groups is an egregious form of this crime and is a special concern. While the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers is a global phenomenon, the 2015 Human Trafficking Report indicates, as it has in the past, that the practice is most critical in Asia and Africa. Children are often abducted, or at times sold, to be used as combatants. In addition to participating in combat-related activities, children are sometimes forced to engage in hazardous activities, such as laying mines, and are frequently killed or wounded. Some have been forced to commit atrocities, and most suffer psychological scarring. Both female and male child soldiers are often sexually abused, or at high risk of contracting sexually transmitted diseases. In 2008, our nation enacted a law that requires the Secretary of State to identify countries that have governmental armed forces or government-supported armed groups that recruit and use child soldiers. The law requires that the Secretary of State compile and publish a list of those countries in the annual trafficking report. These countries then face legal restrictions on access to certain types of U.S. military assistance and training. 8 countries were listed this year: Syria, Burma, Sudan, Somalia, South Sudan, Nigeria, Yemen, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listed last year, the transitional government of the Central African Republic and Rwanda are making progress to reduce the recruitment and use of child soldiers and weren't included on the sanctions and restrictions list. The sale and trafficking of children and their entrapment in any form must be eradicated, and their unlawful recruitment for labor or sexual exploitation in conflict areas must be stopped. All nations must work together with international organizations and non-governmental organizations to take urgent action to disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate unlawful child soldiers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.